make much sense. That should be a law again. Anyone of the convenience at a radio celebration. The audience of mine.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that, of course, is the great Stevie Wonder performing Happy Birthday, a song he wrote for Martin Luther King Jr. He performed at a rally for federal recognition of Martin Luther King Jr. Day on this day in 1981. And many great performers played on that day to fight for that to become a national holiday. It finally is. And speaking of, before we get to our conversation, which actually ties in to the work of Martin Luther King in many ways, I'll remind you to join me, please, on January the 30th at the Governor Calvert House in Annapolis for the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit. We really want you to join us there as part of the live audience. It's a program that features all of our elected, many of our elected political officials. Governor-elect Larry Hogan, who will be governor by then, will be in-house to answer your questions, along with Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Michael Bush and the newly elected Attorney General Brian Frosch, all joining us there. So please become part of the audience. All you have to do is go to our partner's website, thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit. That's thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit for tickets, or call Claire Sheehan at 443-524-8101. That's 443-524-8101 to get your tickets to join us the morning of January the 30th for our 12th Annual Annapolis Summit. And the Annapolis Summit is sponsored by The Daily Record, Stevenson University, BG&E, the Maryland State Education Association, the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, Alexander and Cleaver, and of course, WEAA. But join us there on the 30th. Speaking of all things political and Martin Luther King Day and organizing that can change things from the bottom up and the ground roots up, we're talking with the folks once again who are fighting the incinerator in Curtis Bay and the amazing organizing they've done. The New York Times did a piece on them in the last week, a small video which we'll be posting to on our site about the work they're doing. And we also saw the other news in the New York Times that the world of incinerators is now having a manufacturing boom and opening up sites across America. The largest one may be right here in Baltimore, which is what these folks are fighting. We are joined in the studio by Destiny Watford, who has been a leader of this since her high school days with Free Your Voice, and now is a sophomore at Towson University and still organizing. Destiny, great to have you back in the studio.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And Greg Sotwell is with us. Greg is leadership organizer of United Workers, and this has been the keystone of his work. Good to have you with us as well.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
410-319-8888. Please join us here with your ideas and thoughts. You can also write to us at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages. So please join, and we'll get this call from Washington right after we get the intro here, 410-319-8888. So talk about this. Take us back. This began what year, Destiny? When did this all start?
The incinerator campaign?
Yeah, yeah.
Or
to stop the incinerator in Curtis Bay.
We first learned about the project in 2012, I believe, through a Baltimore Brew article, and none of the members of the group knew anything about the issue, even though it was going on in our own community. And so we just basically started organizing from there and not, like, actually going out and doing any action, but just learning more about the incinerator. And what we learned shocked us so much so that all of this began. The entire campaign was kind of born from that.
And I mean, Curtis Bay itself, one of the things I think that people can see when they look at the New York Times short video that they did on the organizing efforts in Curtis Bay to stop this, I mean, A, people need to go to Curtis Bay and just feel the community for itself, because it is one of the few communities in Baltimore that is, I mean, it's a working class and poor working class community, and a truly interracial community that doesn't happen very much in our town either. People standing together like this is a kind of a new thing for our town as well for a long time. But Greg, I mean, because people don't realize is the amount of how toxic the neighborhood is, just in terms of what it's already facing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes straight to the heart of this matter, which is it's an environmental justice issue, and it's about equity and fairness. So Curtis Bay has the highest levels of toxic air emissions in the entire state of Maryland, and as recently as 2008, in the entire nation, the entire United States. And that's from a long history of Curtis Bay, Fairfield, Brooklyn being used essentially as a dumping ground. for development policy and an economic system that shifts the costs onto some communities, and that's economic costs, social costs, health costs, and costs to our environment. And so, yeah, the community is absolutely filled with industrial sources. It's already the home of the largest medical waste incinerator in the entire country. And so adding the, the largest trash burning incinerator, which would be burning 4,000 tons of trash per day, would only make things worse.
And it's got one of the worst cases of toxic air, and define what that means, toxic air, in the country. What does that mean?
So there's staggeringly high levels of fine particulate matter. That's PM 2.5, which is linked to increased mortality rates across the board. There was a study recently in MIT, an MIT study that showed that Baltimore City as a whole has the highest rate of air pollution-related deaths in the entire country of all major cities. And that mortality rate is more than the homicide rate. Okay, it's almost four times greater than the homicide rate in Baltimore City. And so it's an issue that we're not talking about enough, but that's really staggering.
So let me go open the phones here, 410-319-8888. And this is a struggle being organized from the ground by high school students. That's where it began, who wanted to take their community back and have control over what happens in their community. They've built a garden and a place for people to live and be. But people are standing up here, and this is kind of these hidden issues that people are not paying enough attention to. We'll talk about some alternatives to all this at 410-319-8888. Neil in Washington, D.C., welcome to the program.
Hi, Eric. It's a pleasure talking to you again after all this time. Thank you for taking the call.
Thanks for calling.
I think it's quite wonderful how articulate the students in the Curtis Bay area are on this issue. They've done their research. They've done it well. And I want to make two short comments. One, the New York Times piece talking about a boom in garbage incineration construction is absolutely not true. They're struggling to get plants built. They're being defeated. Proposed plants are being defeated all over the place. And it's a repeat of the 1980s and 90s when over 300 of these plants were killed by citizen action. But let me also make one last comment on alternatives.
Sure,
The land in Curtis Bay is industrial land. There are recycling companies, composting companies, reuse companies. I work with them all over the country. They want to locate in inner cities to get the raw materials they need for manufacturing. And that land, if it were used as an industrial park for this array of small to mid-sized companies, could create over 1,000 jobs, good jobs. The incinerator, even though it's going to be a vast size of 4,000 tons per day, at most will have 50, 60 jobs in it. So for economic reasons, to complement the environmental reasons that Denise and Todd are talking about, I think this is a very serious situation, but it's also a great opportunity for the city and the community to move forward with environmentally sound green industrial development.
So let me just stop for a second before you leave, Neil, and I ask you to comment on one thing extra and go back to our panelists to comment even further. I really want to focus in on what you were just saying about the alternatives to what it to be really clear about the kinds of businesses we're talking about, what can be built that are green industries or greener industries on the same area land that can do that can yield almost 1,000 jobs. I mean, I think I want to kind of parse that out a bit more.
Oh, for instance, there's one company, Gray's Paper Company, in Edmonton, Canada. They want to build dozens of small-scale paper mills. They need 5 acres. They want high-grade white paper and old cotton, and they'll make new high-grade paper for sale. 5 acres. They have their own money, 120 jobs. There's another company that New Life Glass that processes CRT screens, computer screens, to separate the lead and the glass and then bring those to industry. That's another 100 jobs, maybe another 350,000 square feet under roof. Then there are the smaller scale companies such as greenhouse composting and food production companies that are springing up all over the country, including Prince George's County and Baltimore itself. We just released a report in Maryland, not necessarily Baltimore, but in Maryland, if municipal organics were composted, there would be 1,400 new jobs in the state just from composting and using the materials for landscape and agriculture. And finally, there are the reuse jobs. There's one group in Lane County, Oregon, St. Vincent de Paul, that the Institute works with. They create jobs all across the country repairing appliances, cars, mattresses, books, textiles, just about anything, any product that can be electronic scrap, computers. They've created over 500 jobs and in their community around Lane County, Oregon, Eugene, Oregon. And since the Great Recession we've had in 2008-09, they've hired 100 new people and raised wages. This is a company that wants to work with existing nonprofits so that we can create jobs in Baltimore and also provide good reused materials for consumers. In Lane County, over the last 10 or so years, St. Vincent's operations have reduced the cost of living for low-income people by 3% because they can go to 12 thrift stores and buy appliances, mattresses, refrigerators at very low prices, and they're very high quality with guarantees.
So I'm going to turn back to a panel for a minute, Neil, because I think you outlined something here that is an alternative to what the incentives are. And I'm glad you also corrected what I was saying earlier about the New York Times article on the rise in incinerator development around the country and maybe the opposite happening. Tell me how this fits into your organizing.
It's really exciting. What I would say is if anyone is excited at all about what Neil was just talking about and outlining, we're holding an event this Saturday, January 17th, in Curtis Bay, in the community, to learn more about these positive alternatives and really get specific, but also talk about what we mean by positive alternatives. What it really highlights to me is that it's a false choice to be thinking about environment versus jobs and versus economy. It's a false choice presented by examples like the incinerator, where it puts us in a terrible position to have to choose between our health and a promise of really a small amount of jobs for the sake of economic development. And what we were just hearing are real concrete examples and case studies where we don't have to choose and where we can do good for ourselves, for our communities, and also protect the environment, the only environment that we have.
Destiny?
I think Neil's actually right, because the incinerator, the proposed incinerator site is a lot of space, and that gives us the opportunity to fill that space with positive alternatives, like he was mentioning. Right now, we have met with this amazing community member who had proposed solar and wind as an opportunity.
Somebody from the community itself.
Yeah. It is really, really cool. So we are really excited about, you know, opening the door for these positive alternatives to come in to our community and be a part of it, so that we can start changing the history of Curtis Bay around from being like this place of continuous failed development to something truly beautiful and amazing.
You had an action at the school board, right?
Yeah.
And what was the result of that?
Well, we invited the school members
Baltimore
out
City
to
school
the community.
We're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Right.
We invited them out to the community, and a few of them came, and we basically toured around the community, because I think it's, like you were saying earlier, like it's one thing to see Curtis Bay in like a video or read about it in an article, but it's another thing to actually be there. You know, they were shocked to see all of this, and they wanted to continue a discussion, and we have been. And the hopes is that in April we'll be able to, or they will get out of their contract.
They being the,
yeah, so
the school board with the incinerator, you mean?
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for.
Yeah, and so just to add a little bit, that's right on. And the reason that we were going to the school board, the Baltimore City School Board, is that Baltimore City Schools and 21 other public entities across the region are actually in contracts to purchase energy from the incinerator. That was a deal that was made back in 2011. At the same time, that incineration was bumped up to Tier 1 renewable energy in Maryland. At the same time, the company, Energy Answers, gave $100,000 to the Democratic Governors Association to make that happen.
Wait, you think this is a connection?
I don't know. I'll leave that one up to the viewers to connect those dots. And so that leaves us in a really damaged position in terms of our legal framework in the state of Maryland. And so just to step back, so entities, our public institutions, have invested in this incinerator. And so we went to the school board and they came to a tour. And what we're asking institutions to do is to pledge to get out of those contracts in favor of positive alternatives like the ones that we've been describing. And with the schools, it's been a really productive process. At the same time, though, I got to mention, we've been reaching out similarly to the Baltimore Museum of Art and the Walters Art Gallery.
Because
they're also in contracts. They would be buying energy from the nation's largest trash burning incinerator, which would be polluting neighborhoods.
So let me just stop for a moment. I want to get this straight here, because one side of the press, when you talk about the incinerator being a renewable source of energy, mm-hmm. and that means it's good in most people's minds. It's renewable. That means it's healthy for us. It's not oil. We're taking old stuff and recycling it and making it into energy that we can use for our houses and our homes and our lives and our businesses. But what you're contending, what people are contending who oppose the incinerator, and we did try to get people on who are part of the incinerator. We could not get them on the program with you all today. But is that the incinerator is polluting the community. Let's be very clear about what your argument is about how that's happening.
Yeah.
What does that mean, it pollutes the community?
Yeah. Okay. So let's just look at the numbers. So this incinerator has been permitted to emit 240 pounds of mercury per year. It would make it one of the largest mercury emitters in the state. 1,000 pounds of lead per year. Studies have shown there's no safe level of exposure to lead, as well as fine particulate matter, which is one of the most dangerous forms of air pollution.
Which is the stuff that we breathe in. You cannot see it.
It's so small, it embeds deep in your lungs. And so when we're talking about heavy metals along with fine particulate matter, it's particularly dangerous. So it's worse than coal in terms of the amount of energy it produces. When you compare it to coal, these incinerators are actually more damaging to the air that we're breathing. The way that they've been treated as renewable energy is marketing, dirty politics, and greenwashing. And so the roots of our campaign is really to reclaim the definition of what renewable energy means.
So other than the people themselves that you've been organizing for years, and you've been organizing around this at Towson, which I want you to talk about in a moment as well, Destiny, mm-hmm. What does it take to stop this incinerator?
That's a big question. I think at the root, what you need in order to stop, or what we need in order to stop this incinerator is, first of all, a core set of values of what you believe in, and just figuring out if the incinerator, first of all, even, or rather figuring out how the incinerator violates said values, and just going from there, you know, bringing in people that know more about the issue in detail than you could, and learning from them and researching and, you know, reaching out to other folks to get support and to help out. And
yeah. What would it mean for the state or the city to cancel this contract, to not allow it to happen? I mean the deal has been signed by the state, right?
Right. And so just a little more on that. And so what Destiny said is right on. We need to organize if we're going to stop this. But our strategy is actually really strong. And it leads directly to actually what Neil was saying on the phone, which is that incinerators are failing. The comeback is, if it's a comeback, it's one of the weakest comebacks you could imagine. I mean, there hasn't been an incinerator built in the U.S. since 1995. And they fail in
large. A little bit like nuclear power.
Yeah. And they fail because of organizing, but also because of the economics. So this is a $1 billion project. It needs private financing in order to be constructed. And the way they're going to attract financing is to find buyers for their energy. So far, the majority of the buyers are the public institutions that I mentioned. And
what would be their alternative?
Right. Well,
what would these institutions' alternatives?
Absolutely. And that's what we're trying to develop. So solar, wind are cheaper than the energy that comes from a trash-burning incinerator. Trash-burning incinerators are the most expensive way of producing energy and of dealing with waste. So the alternatives are out there. The challenge is to create a process to actually develop them. And so that's what we want to do with the entities.
So, Destin, I'm curious. Have you had – let's just out of curiosity, the thing that popped in my head as you were just speaking, mm-hmm. because these are both very kind of progressive, forward-thinking women who run these two institutions you're talking about, the Walters Art Museum and the BMA. Have they come out to the community? Have you brought them out to the community?
As in, like leaders of.
Yeah, like, as you did with the school board. Have you? I mean, the leaders of the BMA and the Walters to bring them out to the community and hear these conversations.
We have this amazing group of people that we all brought together from different institutions, and together we've reached out to the BMA and the Walters Museum, Art Museum, but we haven't heard a response yet.
Yeah, and so that's something that we are hopeful that the BMA and the Walters will do the right thing and that they will respond to our offer to sit down, talk about this. But there is a sense of urgency. We need to start the process now. The schools are a good model of the way to start this process. And the reason there's a sense of urgency is that all the public entities have the opportunity to opt out of their contracts in the spring of 2015. Energy Answers has a deadline to start producing power by that date. And if they don't do so, which they won't, they said in the Times that the earliest would be 2017, then all the entities are free to leave the contracts. And so we're asking for entities to first meet with us, talk about the issue, come to the community, and then work together to get out of those contracts.
One of the things I think is so important about the things that the two of you are talking about, Destiny, is that what this has shown, I mean, we don't know how this is going to end up, but the idea of stopping this incinerator from being built and that the idea of the real health of this community and recreating, but the more important, almost as importantly, is recreating, as you'd put it, Destiny, the vibrancy of this neighborhood of Curtis Bay has become so desolate and left out behind to rot away, and you're not going to let that happen. It's really showing kind of the power that can happen from the bottom up when you start serious work like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody would have thought you'd be this far.
Yep, that's pretty accurate.
So, I mean, what does that say to you? What does that say about the power of young people and the power of organizing?
Well, first of all, I just like to say that organizing, it's not easy. But I think that the reason it's so powerful is that you're bringing in a group of people with an issue that is similar, with a similar issue. So by that I just mean you have an issue that affects a bunch of people and people care about said issue. And so all these people are coming together in order to make a difference. And I think that's what makes it so powerful, and that's what's so significant about organizing.
And I think it also shows the power of young people, which is something we keep forgetting all the time. Every time some of the old codgers will say something, I have to remind them that when we were in the civil rights movement back in the early 60s or in the anti-war movement of those days, we were all 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old and doing the organizing. So you're showing it is happening again, which is, I think, is a very powerful moment. And Neil Feldman's call back with a final thought, Neil, before we have to go to break. What is that?
Yes, very quickly, about the purchasing of the energy. The energy costs are going down, as we all know, and that's why the industry needs to be put in this renewable category so they could charge more for their energy. The bottom line is that these institutions that are buying dirty energy could be buying energy from traditional sources at just about the same price, because the garbage burning industry is subsidized by these rules that they're taking advantage of for renewables that should be going to wind and solar.
Well, we'll continue to look at this. This is in our own backyard, and I think it's a very important national story, which is why the New York Times covered it in such an elegant way, I think, in a powerful way, in that short video they produced about the work you all are doing, which we'll be linking to on our website at steinershow.org for everybody to see. And I once again, it's been just an honor to have Destiny Watford back in the studio, one of the organizers and founders of Free Your Voices, pushed this thing from the community when she was in high school. She's now a sophomore at Towson and still organizing around this issue. Well, great to see you, Destiny, and thanks for everything you do for our community.
Thank you.
Good to have you here in the studio. And it's good to have Greg Saltwell as well, who's leadership organizer of the United Workers, that has taken this on as one of their lead struggles, one of the United Workers, to make this happen. He's the lead organizer in Curtis Bay. Good to have you here with us as well. And Neil Friedman, thanks for calling in. So good luck.
Thank you.
We'll see where this goes. We'll stay on top of this with you and see what happens in this wonderful organizing. And what's happening, again, very quickly before we go, on Saturday?
Yeah. So Saturday, January 17th at Benjamin Franklin High School in Curtis Bay. Join us. Positive Alternatives discussion. It's going to be great. And also reach out to the BMA and the Walters and join in our call for them to divest.
On the way to break, we're hearing American Pie, Don McLean, which hit number one on this day in 1972. We'll be right back with Dr. Carla Hayden, Chief Executive Officer of Enoch Pratt Library. Don't go away.